Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. Before we get to today's conversation, I want to share with you how you can support my podcast, which is independently produced. You can find and support me on Patreon or through my website, www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com, where you'll find a tab that shows how you can support me through a few different ways. Your support helps keep this podcast going and gets more women's stories out to the world. We talk a lot about representation and the importance of seeing women in STEM fields, which is what this podcast does. Your support is really important to help keep that going. So, on to today's podcast. This week's podcast guest is really just a delight to talk with. Sherry Shannon Vanstone is just an amazing woman with a rich STEM background in so many areas. She started out by getting a degree in mathematics, which I love. As you all know, I love mathematics, which then led to a career as a cryptology mathematician. She went on to work in Silicon Valley and has gone on to start or co-found 5 companies. She's a serial entrepreneur with a deep background in encryption. Her latest venture is Profound Impact, a female-founded Canadian data analytics company that leverages AI and machine learning to provide solutions for the higher education and research sectors. Sherry is passionate about equity for women in STEM, women in sport, women founders, and living her why of connecting great people to do great things. Sherry began her career over 40 years ago and has a wide breadth and depth of knowledge and experience. I just absolutely loved our conversation, and I hope you enjoy her story. Hi. I am really excited to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I am looking forward to talking to you too.
I just want to start off with, what do you do for, I'm not even going to say for a job, because I feel like you do a lot of other things besides just a job that play into STEM.
My why is connecting great people to do great things. That's also my company's why. And so I feel that if I'm doing that in not my company, but also in my philanthropic areas and also in my volunteer activities, whether it's mentoring young women in physics or raising funds for initiatives for young women for specific initiatives in STEM or non-STEM activities. So I try to tie everything together where it's a more of a cohesive, holistic view. My impact.
Let me ask you this, because I've been an engineer for 30 years. I'm an electrical engineer. And I really had, I feel like for a long time, I very much had the separation of work and family and my social life and my other activities. And then as I've gotten older, I've found that they are starting to blend together a lot more. And I think part of it is, I think, the podcast, because I spend a lot of time talking with women in different STEM fields and trying to build community, and a whole lot of things that came about from the podcast that I did not expect. Like, I did not know what I was doing with the podcast. I had time on my hands during COVID, but I have found like a combination of that. I started a nonprofit in Africa, which actually has nothing to do with STEM, although I'm trying to also, I have like a long-term vision once we get children fed and healthy and things like that, trying to do some systemic changes that I think Girls in STEM plays into. I just am not there yet. But I feel like all of these things, as I've gotten older, have started to come together in a way that I never really thought about or never really expected or never really planned, in a way that I feel like is making life richer, especially like my kids are getting older. So I have more time to do stuff. I think when you're younger, like you just try to get through the day, like when you've got young kids and you're trying to raise a family and work and all of those things. But when you talk about what you do and about how this is like your why and your company's why, did you plan it that way? Or is your story similar and you just ended up there because it's where your heart is?
My why has changed over the years, but there's always been a basic component in it. It is about respect for other, diversity of thought, inclusiveness. I did say most of my activities are around women in STEM, but I also am involved in women in sport. Mm-hmm. So bringing equity and inclusion in, whether at the club level all the way up to the Olympics. So my goal has had that core element, but how it's been expressed has changed over time. In particular, what role I played, let's say at a company, which I didn't run when I was in Silicon Valley. It was a very toxic environment there. And I wanted to make a difference and change that environment for inclusivity. Many individuals that were not being welcomed. And so I found I could do so much, but I couldn't do it as what I can do now, running a company and have working with our team to build a culture of inclusivity and diversity of thought. So again, I go back to this is my core part. How it's been manifested over time has changed. And most, it depends again on, as you said, what you've done in Africa, what you can do financially is different than you could maybe 20 years ago, and what you can do with your time, and also what you can do in your specific role.
I think it's just, it's so interesting how, when you look back on things, how things come together in ways that you never really imagined. I want to go back to your start for a couple reasons. So you have a degree in math, which I want to talk about because I don't find many M's in STEM very often. And I love math. Math was my favorite thing, my favorite subject when I went to school. If I wasn't an engineer, I always said that I probably would have taught calculus. Unfortunate. It sounds so weird, but I feel like it's unfortunate that I don't spend my life doing math. Everything's done by computers now, so we don't really do like math equations and things like that. And I really did love math. How did you get interested in math? And how did you decide to do that when you went to college?
When I was around 7 or 8, my father, who was an operating engineer, meaning he operated heavy equipment on construction sites, he wanted to become an electrical engineer. And of course, that takes a lot of training from where he was. But there was certain courses that were offered at that time. And they were from an organization called the International Correspondence School. Mm-hmm. And he would get these booklets, and then he would complete them, all the coursework. Then there was some lessons in it, and then there was some exercises, and you did the exercises, and then you sent them back in the mail. They graded them, and then they sent you the next booklet. So at that time, my dad was working through this, and I started working through the booklets that once he would do it myself. So I found then that I gained this interest. So seemed to be good at it. And it may be because I was interested in it. I became better at it. And so by the time I reached 5th grade, I grew up in Ohio. So they have the standardized test. And I scored 10th grade in mathematics.
Oh, wow.
It was my teachers told me that. They shared that information with me. And that gave me confidence. That also encouraged me. And I felt motivated. I love this. So great. I'm good in it. And when I went on to high school, I had very good and dedicated female high school math teachers.
Really?
Yes. And they all took a special interest in me. One is because I was one of the few women that excelled in mathematics at that level. But also, they wanted to help me to excel even more. So they would give me tutoring classes on the side, free classes, since they were helping me prepare to go to university. And if there was a course that was at the high school, they wanted me to be prepared. So they would tutor me. So it was really encouraging having those supporters in high school.
And then how did you decide to major in math? And especially from, I want to say from a standpoint, I think we are close to the same age. You might be a little bit older, but I'm going to guess, and you talked about this just a couple minutes ago, that even when you were going into university, probably one of the few women going into math. Is that correct?
Yes. I really didn't know what to do with math, although I had wonderful teachers in high school. I guess that's really what I was thinking. Would I be a teacher? But I knew I really enjoyed numbers. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to be an accountant. I don't know where I got that idea. So I went to University of Miami in Ohio, and I started my coursework in accounting. And I also wanted to be a journalist. And so I was the university newspaper, and they gave me the assignment. Why me? I don't know why, but they gave me an assignment to interview the president for a certain reason. And I did. I went into the president's office and was interviewing him, and he said to me, after the interview, he started asking about me, my courses, what I was studying. And then he started asking my ACT score. That's what I took instead of SAT. Mm-hmm. And he goes, wait a minute. You should not be an accountant. You should be a mathematician. And he changed all my courses. Now, I felt honored and I didn't feel put out at all. He did, David, because I was excited about it too, because I hadn't even thought about it, about the difference between being an accountant and being a mathematician. I think if I'd have been an accountant, I would have been a great accountant. I just feel because I loved numbers and I would have succeeded in it. But he gave me a way to, he changed all my courses for me. He can do it. I couldn't have probably done it on my own.
Precedents are probably pretty helpful that way.
So that started me on the way to say, okay, I'm going to be a mathematician. And that journey took me to graduate school and then to be a cryptologic mathematician with the U.S. government, which I didn't even know what that was when I was deciding to be a mathematician. And today, there's all types, as we know, different occupations that are founded on a very strong STEM education that didn't even exist 15 years ago or 10 years ago.
Okay, what is a cryptology mathematician? Is that what you said?
A cryptographic mathematician.
Cryptographic, okay.
Cryptologic, cryptographic, sometimes called cryptologic. It is where you use mathematics to develop codes. And those codes could be used for confidentiality, the data. It can be used for data integrity, data authentication, all of these features of data. So if you wanted for you and I, a confidential, maybe call it secret conversation, we would use an algorithm, a cryptographic algorithm. And today we use them all the time and we don't know. Our banking, we sign into our bank, there's all these algorithms behind it. And they're all based on very sophisticated, challenging mathematics, which is great when you get into them. When I graduated, I wanted to be a teacher, I had thought, but then I decided I wasn't going to be, not at a high school level, maybe at a university level. So that's why I went on to graduate school. But then I found out after I received my master's degree, I really wanted to not go on to get my PhD at that time. And so I took this job. But when I was interviewing, many of the jobs I was interviewing for didn't necessarily utilize the mathematics the way I wanted to do. There was some more actuarial-ish mm-hmm. type of roles, some offers that I received that I could walk back to school and become an engineer, because that's the skill set they wanted, although they liked my foundation in mathematics. But what I was able to do at the U.S. government, use mathematics in this area of cryptologic mathematics. And that means then you could make these codes, and then you also use mathematics to break codes used by other governments.
So Is that what you did? Oh, so you were like a code breaker. Oh, wow. Okay, that sounds really cool. It sounds like something I would see in a movie. Is it as cool as it seems or sounds or seems in a movie?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Now, the different ways I was not a computer scientist, but I would need to coding, writing code, research my own ideas, or if I came up with an approach, like I believe we should take this approach to break this code, I would need to write the algorithm for it. So that was interesting because the other computer scientists kept pointing out to me that I wasn't a computer scientist. And I said, that's fine. I'm not trying to be a computer scientist. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to use my mathematics in this way. So I pushed myself. I learned new skills. I was able to do a program that became operational. My own code, not being a computer scientist, was at that time, the Cray computer, using a language that was specific to the organization I was working with. It was so fascinating and what you could do with the mathematics. Of course, there was a lot of extra training that I received too. It wasn't just what I had learned at university.
Right.
There were a lot of other additional courses that we in the program I was. Yes, it was exciting and it was challenging. I was able to work in many different areas, classified and unclassified areas, in this role that I had with the U.S. government.
So with there being so many computers now and computers doing everything, do people still Because I have the same issue as an engineer, right? Everything is really done by computers. And then it's like you interpret the results to make sure that they make sense. Is that the same thing with that area? Or are there still people that are actually like working in math and with equations and doing things by hand versus putting them into a computer? And I realize people need to program computers, right? I understand that. But it just seems like so much stuff, especially on the math side, is done by computers. And we don't really get to use math the way that people did in the past.
In this area of cryptologic and cryptic mathematics, plenty of it. Now, I'm not saying that I do it because I'm no longer practicing and in that role, but my late husband, Dr. Scott Vanstone, was one of the leading mathematicians in the world. And he did everything by hand first. And he had 450 patents. He patented new ideas that were based on mathematics. And so, of course, I could follow. I wasn't as brilliant as he, but he also did it all in his head, too, and then wrote it down. So it was like, so he had his own computer going, literally going in his head. And yeah, so you do get to see that, and you get to work in these areas of algebra and finite fields and different areas that we have rooms and rooms of notebook calculations written down. So yes, in this area. I don't know other areas that well to say that, but it, this specific area, there's still people working with the equations, even on pen and paper.
Oh, that makes me happy. Okay, so now you're like, how did you meet your husband then?
I met him at a mathematics conference, a cryptologic mathematics conference, Davos, Switzerland, in 1988.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So I was working for the U.S. government, just getting ready to leave in the U.S. government to go to Silicon Valley to start up. I met him at this conference and did a couple of papers together. And then I came, he's Canadian, and I came to Canada 29 years ago to work for his company that he started that was a spin out of the University of Waterloo. And then we became involved after that. So that's how I met him. And we had the foundation of mathematics for the relationship.
I feel like there's got to be some kind of a formula that like that has to lead into there.
Yes, I have even thought about writing, and I'm sure there are people who have written it already, is about the equation, relationship equations, I call them, different relationship equations. And one of them that I have is that one plus a number that's greater than one, or so let's say a number that's multiplied together, let's say two numbers, if they're greater than one, what happens when you multiply them together? They
make
grow,
it much bigger.
Right? Yes. But what if you're less than one?
They get smaller.
They get smaller. So when you're in a relationship and you both are whole people, you're one and you're mine, there's an exponential growth when you two get together.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Anyway, that's one of the relationship equations that that would be great to maybe just do a little book about equations that could be applied to relationships.
I think you should. That sounds beautiful. Oh, all right. That makes my heart happy. Okay, so tell me how you went from being in the government to Silicon Valley. What was that track for you, and what was like the rest of your career path?
In the U.S. government, I worked in the best job I could ever have. This was my sixth year. I started in this office in my fourth year at the organization, and it was the best job. I loved it. It was a liaison job between business and technical, and I really excelled in it. I received two promotions in 1 year. And when I was traveling one time with my boss's boss, he told me, he said, Sherry, you know you're going to have to move on from this office if you want to move up, because you're at a level. Your boss is going to retire, stay until he retires, and his job. So you will have to go to another office in this organization. And I thought about that. And because I'd been in this specific program, almost like an internship program, where I spent 6 months in an office, three of the years that I was there, I really thought, I don't know another place I want to go within this organization. So I decided, if I'm going to leave, I'm going to leave. And I'm going to try something different. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something that I wanted to really bet on myself and take risk and put my own destiny in my own hands. So I decided that I wanted to go to Silicon Valley and I wanted to work with a startup in information security, so the same area that I'm in, but on the commercial side. And I wanted to be a head of Asia Pacific sales. Now, all of that made sense at that time to me. And the company that I worked said, yes, we would love for you to come. And we'd love for you to be a head of Asia Pacific. And they gave me the opportunity. That's what startups, that's a good thing about startup. You often name your role and you can change your role quickly or stay in a role for a longer term. So I wanted to do Asia Pacific and Latin America because I had a degree in Spanish also. And I said, this is what I want to do. And I'll still stay on that little bit of the technical side. This will be business, building out distribution channels, working with customers. I got to Asia Pacific and I just loved it. I had 13 different countries. I set up distribution channels. I traveled by myself to all those countries, even Japan, very successful in Japan, even being a Western woman, and did drop the Latin America work because I just was too busy with the Asia Pacific. So I had an opportunity to build a whole distribution network and support network that supported all of our multinational customers, which we had IBM, Citibank, all the large, everyone was using our product. And I was able to build that. And along the way, I mentioned working with some women and bringing them into the organization and then helping them stand up for them in a male-dominated company.
We talked a little bit about your experience in university, but how was your experience like in the government and then Silicon Valley from a standpoint of being a female? And like how long, this was a while ago, right? So I'm going to guess there were even less women than there are now, which we still are not a lot, but probably even less. How was that experience for you? And did you find challenges? Did you find one more challenging than the other? Because both of them seem like they could be challenging in their own way from being female.
I think they're both challenging in two ways. One is that the male dominant, both organizations and even the startup in Silicon Valley. What with the government one was that not only did I have all of, and I would say it was, I acknowledged that I was the only woman at a certain level, but I can say that when I came into the program and there was a specific program I was recruited to when I came out of university, there were equal women as there were males in this program.
Really?
In that time. Wow. I think there were 26 of us, 13 and 13.
Wow.
And I don't know if that just happened at that time because I really wasn't following it that closely. Mm-hmm. Was it on purpose? During the program, that was great, but then we all were in different offices. We weren't working together, the 26 of us. So when I did finally end up in this office that I really excelled at, I was the only woman at a certain level. And so one day I walk in and I know they're talking about me, and I hear one of the older gentlemen say, if she can't handle the heat, she should just get out of the kitchen. So I knew they were talking. I thought, oh, well, I'm not going to fight this battle. I'm not going to bring it up. I didn't even ask what they were talking about. I just let it go. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, I think what's important, knowing what battles to fight and what to back off of. However, it was another gentleman that was in my office who was my immediate boss at early days, and he was great with me, but he was often demeaning to administrative workers, the people who were working in the office, which were mostly women that were in these roles. And he would not, with respect. In fact, he would yell at them and curse them.
Oh, wow.
And so one day he turned to me and he said something to me in the same tone he used with them and in the same manner. And I just stopped him. You don't talk to me that way. And he backed down and he never spoke to me again. So I felt like I had to choose my battles. I let the one, I'm going to ignore it. But this one, no, I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to stand up for myself. And he then backed off. And then he never spoke to me again that way. And I'm hoping that I influenced him a little bit in how he spoke to other women. So then when I went to Silicon Valley, I had the same thing. The president and CEO of the company was a male chauvinist. And he demeaned not just women. He demeaned everyone in the company. And I was one of the few that could stand up to him and just say, you don't talk to me like that. You don't treat me that way. And you don't treat my people that way. And that was when I was telling you earlier about saying I wanted, my why became, now I want to fight for others, just not for myself.
Right.
But I also want to start saying, I want to also fight for others in any way I can, in any role. Like, I felt that was a great why I had then. And then when I came to Canada, I had a different why. I wanted to build a company that had that culture, again, I'm repeating myself, but of inclusivity and diversity of thought and respect.
I think I'm going to guess that, like, when you were coming up in the early part of your career, because it's probably, I want to say maybe 10 years before me or something like that, something along those lines.
Probably.
First of all, I have to say kudos to you for standing up, because I don't think that I had a spine to stand up with until I was probably in my mid 30s. I don't want to say you feel like a fish out of water, because it's not that. It's just that you're accepting, right? This is like what life is. And it seems too big to change, right? There's too many people. I wasn't the first woman engineer at my company, but I was the second woman engineer and the first one that went out in the field. So in some cases, it's like you have to pave the way and you have to be accepting of how you're treated. But also, I wasn't necessarily treated badly. There were certain things that were, but at the same time, it's like you're also at an anomaly. And so there's also, I want to say, some, I don't know if it's good things, but things about being different that make it okay. And it's just, you just feel like it's part of life. Like, not necessarily something to change, or not even necessarily something to fight, or that you even know that you can fight until I think later on. At least for me, that's how it went. And it's now, and I don't even feel like it's necessarily something to fight. It's more of, I feel it's something to help women navigate, help other women navigate, and help them not to feel alone. And I don't think we're fighting like that many men. I think we're fighting maybe like a handful of men. For the most part, like, most of the men that I've worked with have been great. It's just you have this handful that can make your life miserable.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's just not necessarily that, as you said, it's just that saying, okay, I'm a woman, I'm going to have this chip on my shoulder, I'm going to come in a bull in China shop and try to disrupt things. I was already a disruptor being a woman, as you are, in the room. You're treated as an anomaly. And that was the way I was in Japan. In fact, they didn't know how to treat me. They called me Sherry-san. We don't know how to treat you. Are you a man? Are you a woman? Because that was a cultural thing too, the gender. I felt that I worked well with people. I did not have a chip in my mind. I wasn't looking to have a fight. Most of the time, they were very supportive. But I also stood up. I stood up maybe one or two times and said, you don't treat me this way. And then people knew that. I didn't have to fight at that battle again at the U.S. government in Silicon Valley. I stand up for myself there. I chose specific ways to do it. I believe I came in with I'm a good worker. I will do my part. I'm not going to sit back. One of the reasons I love my job is when there was a special assignment, I threw out my hand. I'll do that. You want to do this? Oh, we need somebody to volunteer. I'll do that. So I was volunteering and learning and stretching myself so much. I was really excited. And later, some of the young men who were working at the same role I was said, why does Jerry get all the good assignments? I didn't necessarily get it. I didn't know they were going to be good assignments. I just wanted to learn. And I stretched and said, I'm going to take the risk. Maybe I fail at it. Maybe I succeed at it. I'm going to learn.
So after Silicon Valley, and then you go to Canada, how many companies have you started?
I have five companies.
Okay. So is this all after Silicon Valley and after going to Canada?
Yeah.
And how did you find starting companies and getting funding and that process? Because I do want to get into that, because I've had a number of female founders and been talking a lot about investing and the challenges that women face in investing. Or getting investors, I should say. So I want to get into that. But how did you start down that path? And what were some of the things that you found along that way?
I co-founded a couple of companies too. So with my late husband. So that helped. I learned a lot in that process. And then when he passed, I've been running a couple of companies. So I've had failures. I've had successes. And I've learned from them all. I thought the last time I sold a company was in 2017. And I thought that was it. And all of my companies up until my current company was all in information security.
Okay.
We were information security. As I said, I was selling these big link encryptors, they're called. They're physical boxes that were used to encrypt all the data that went across the network, whether it's voice, video, data. All of it was encrypted. So I did that. And then I then went to more software over time. Mm-hmm. No more of a software. And then some was embedded. I worked for Certicom. That was a company my late husband founded. And that company, we did all the security for BlackBerry, and all cell phones have algorithms in them today. So that was called embedded security. So it was security, and then it started changing. I did boxes, then to embedded and software. Along the way, I had a lot of credibility in the space. And I also had visibility with the other information people who were experts in information security. I might not have been the smartest, had the most patents. I knew the people. I also knew who to hire and not to hire in the circles. So when I started raising money, I had a lot of credibility in that space. So I'm not saying raising money is easy. It's never been easy, even from the 19th to today. I think it's a little harder today, and I'll talk about that. Mm. But because of my experience and the longevity and the experience that I had, I knew how to pull together a good team of people, and I had visibility and credibility with the right people, the investors, many of them, because many of them had invested in previous companies I was involved with. Okay. So, now, in 2017, I sell my company thinking I'm never going to start another one. And I come up with this idea, almost hoisted on me, about measuring impact, individual impact, and collective impact of an organization. So I started working with the University of Waterloo math faculty, who I have credibility and visibility with also. And we came up with this idea of this platform, which we did develop in conjunction with them. And they're still utilizing it today. So that was fine. It was small and I didn't need funding. I could fund it myself. We developed another product. And now last year we launched a new product. And now I'm hiring more people. And because I've had successes, I had cash. I had money to do this on my own. But now in my company, Profound Impact, we are poised for substantial growth, for scaling. What we do is we use AI and machine learning to match funding opportunities, whether they're federal, provincial governments or state governments or federal governments in the U.S., with researchers and industry partners. And we use AI to get the best match in order to get the most research for the research dollar in order to help us solve some of the world's greatest problem. It all ties into my why, but the whole thing now, I'm in an area where I'm not the expert. I'm not an expert in AI and machine learning. I have mm-hmm. people who I hire, thank goodness, that have expertise in it. So I come in at a different angle now, and probably to more female founders, because before I was at an event and with the investors. So now I'm not a leading name in this area as somebody who's commercialized this before. So I come in and now I'm saying, okay, now I've really got a pitch. I can establish quickly credibility, but I don't have the visibility any longer. And so that's what I'm working on, is to get more visibility, VCs for my next round. So right now we're at a $3 million round. We close $2.2 million May 5th, and we'll close the rest on August 4th. And now I am having to work for every dollar to get investors in at this time. I don't have a lead investor, and it's very difficult to get one. There's people who will follow a lead investor, but there's very few lead investors. So one of the initiatives, because I've been doing this myself and because I work with a lot of female founders too, is that calling on other women to support. And there are female-founded funding out there. But again, many of it is using the same model of funding that has been used for years and years. And somehow, on purpose, there's some bias in there against women founders. And I believe we should call it out. I'm not saying one individual. I think it's unconscious bias in the process. So let's call that out. And the best way to do it, again, is not to pick a fight, but right. just to show by example, get more women invested. So of the funding that I just completed, the majority were first-time female investors. So I believe that there is a pool of women out there who have never invested, angel invested in their life. And a lot of them have lots of money because many of them are successful philanthropists. And I have a friend who's a successful philanthropist because she uses the same strategy in philanthropy that you would as an investor. She invests in specific companies that are in her why, in her zone, that has this criteria. She puts so much money in that she always keeps follow-on money. She has follow-on money that she continues to put in. I believe there's a lot of women out there that would be excited about learning to invest, angel invest, and becoming part of this funding pool.
One of the things that I wonder, and maybe you have some thoughts about this, I am a worker bee. I don't have a lot of money, but I would love to be able to invest. I invest money for my retirement and things like that. I would love to be able to invest in female founders also. I would love to be able to support that. I don't have enough money that I can be an angel investor, but are there opportunities to bring together women in groups that have that same philosophy, that are in that same position? They want to be able to help move female-founded companies forward, but don't really have large amounts of money to do it. Is that even something that's even feasible? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. I am part of a limited partner. Now, limited partner fund is a commitment every year for so many years. So I've committed 5 years, a certain amount of money. That group is called Phoenix Fire. And one of the funds to me that needs to figure out how to be a leader instead of a follower. But part, it's indirectly related because one of the general partners also started another fund called the Firehood. Phoenix Firehood. And the Firehood has different rules. It's almost like an annual subscription. You pay, you're obligated, if you want to be a part of the Firehood, you put so much money in. But it's a lot less than it's maybe 10% of what your obligation would be at LP, maybe even less than that. And they fund certain opportunities, and they get equity in these companies. And the Firehood, it's called the Firehood. You can Google Danielle Graham, Claudette McCowan, who are also part of Phoenix Fire, founders of the Firehood. And that they founded it just for that reason. There were a lot of women that they were meeting who could not put in the money, invest the money into the limited partnership and the Phoenix Fire Fund. So they created a vehicle. And it seems to be going very well. So I'm sure there's many opportunities like that in the U.S. I haven't heard of them directly. But with this initiative that we, several women, I think there's a group of 15 of us have taken on, is to create more awareness. We're doing an event in the fall in Toronto, and it's going to be an invitation only where we bring in VCs, female founders, female philanthropists, and family offices that hold the money for the female wealthy ladies. And we're bringing all them into the room and saying, this is what we need to do. Now, we've been talking about this for a long time. Let's act. Let's be activators. So let's come up with these different ideas, the different funds where people could come in. There's also the angel networks. I'm sure you've heard of many of them. In Canada, there's a network of them in all the major cities. The one that's local to me is called the Golden Triangle Angel Networks. And they allow women and men at lower numbers. They can aggregate or they can go in on their own. Sometimes they aggregate because the minimum is not what they want to do. So they could aggregate mm-hmm. and come in. Say, instead of saying, okay, we want $25,000, we'd take $5,000 investments. So the angel networks, many of them, it's the companies that pitches to them, whether they aggregate or not in the investment. So there are opportunities that, but not on the scale that we need them, mm-hmm. I believe.
Just like being a woman in STEM, it's probably slow baby steps. Hopefully at some point there's the exponential curve that you get past the baby steps. Hopefully it's sooner rather than later so that we can have a more equitable space.
I think all of these steps matter. And even in my career, I felt often that, especially when I went to Asia Pacific, I'd tell people I'm taking two steps forward and one step back, or maybe one step forward and two steps back. Sometimes it felt that way. Sometimes you don't feel like you're making progress, but you keep stepping forward and doing these things, whether they look like, and they may be baby steps, but I do believe we'll get to the place that we can get the momentum. And I believe that there's this wealth of source of funding that we haven't tapped into. Women supporting women and finding ways. What can we do? How can we structure it where we can include more people into these funding opportunities? As we need to put on our thinking hats to do that. But I think we can do it. And I believe that with a mandate and a collective and the momentum that I think we already have, I believe that we can see things change. Now, I've heard these numbers recently, and I'm still trying to validate them, but I heard that all of VC funding's only 2% in the U.S. go to female-founded companies, and I heard 4% in Canada. But whether it's 2, 4, or 10, it's still too low.
Yeah, I just researched that for another one of my podcast episodes, because I'll usually put resources and things into the episode notes. And yes, it's something like 2% or 4%. It's very low.
Yeah. And knowing that I believe that there's something wrong with the process, not sure exactly what's wrong with it. I'm not a VC, but I'm on the other side of it. So I believe that we can come together and make these, as you said, baby steps. But and then we get the momentum. The good thing about today versus 20 years ago, the momentum can gain a lot of speed, and we could get that exponential growth quicker because of social media, our contacts, our networks. And that's why we're with this activator group that we have Silicon Valley people there. And so we want US, Canada, hopefully internationally someday, but right now we're concentrating on those two to say, okay, can we move that needle? I know we can. But let's think outside of the box. We're not going to do it the way it's been done before, because that's the definition of insanity, right? Doing something the same way and expecting different results. So that's not going to happen. So what can we do? What can we do differently? And I like approaching women who have money and have put, I'm a part of this women's group called Women Moving Millions. There are women out there that have millions of dollars that they put into philanthropy. I said, take a little bit of that and put it into angel investing. Now, it doesn't have to be maybe 1% of your portfolio or whatever. Just put something into angel investing and female-founded companies. And I believe that could be a huge amount of money.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Honestly, this makes my heart happy, because a lot of the conversations that I've been having lately are like women who have founded companies that are trying to figure out how to get funding. I had a woman who went through some horrible experiences trying to get funding, and this is like very recent, that it's just so toxic and so like demeaning to women that it just sounds absolutely horrible. So to hear that there are people like you trying to change this and trying to move the needle, and that there are possibilities. And honestly, like I said, like I would love to somehow get involved in this. I don't know how. I don't have millions. I could be part of like Women Moving Thousands. That's what I feel like. But if we pull our thousands together, they make millions.
Oh, they do. And that's
so,
what we...
Yeah. So this makes my heart very, very happy. Before we move off the funding things, I'm curious about this. You had mentioned that you thought things were easier before than they are now for women trying to get funding. What were you referring to with that?
I was thinking in particular, because I moved into a different industry.
Okay.
And I'm out of my wheelhouse. Whereas, because I had been in that one industry so long, I had, as I said, I had both credibility and visibility to the VCs.
Okay.
Now I'm in a new industry. Now I know it's AI and machine learning, and that's all important, because it is, because we wouldn't be able to do what we do without those tools. However, now it's, to me, economically too, right? There's a challenge today. We know that. So it could be just the cycle that I came in. Mm. Well, I do want to make a comment. I've been pitching a lot, and I pitch probably I should spend more time on my customers and less time on trying to pitch. But right now I have to figure that out, that balance. But I pitched recently in February to a group, and I was the only woman pitching. There were four other companies. I was the only woman pitching. And I say shame on the angel groups because they vet them and that's the only one they put forward. And I had the most experience of any of the founders. And yet, I didn't get it. They didn't invest in me. Yeah. So the whole thing is that where's the bias is there. Now, there were some female investors in the room, but very few. The first that I pitched in the morning, there were no female investors in. In the evening, there were. And I thought, okay. And some I knew. And I was hoping that I could gain. And they stood up. They said they were in. And I did get money from them individually, but I did not get any the money from the collective group. That's why I got on the soapbox recently, because I want to call it out, not individually, just collectively, that this is an issue. We know it's an issue. I'm not the only one saying it.
Oh, right.
But I think all I'm saying is for myself, I happen to be a certain niche at the right time in information security, where security is the underlying enabler of all that we do.
For sure.
Digitally. So that was such an enabler, and I was a known entity in that industry, that it was easier for me to raise money. Now, it's not, because I now am, as I said, like most other female founders, I come in with a level of expertise in certain areas, and then fighting for the credibility and the visibility in this new circle of VCs.
To your point on there not being very many women investors in the room, I think when I did the same research on that there's 2 or 4% of female founders, there's also, I believe it's about 8% of people that work in VC are women. So that's really low too, which is another thing that needs to change.
Yes. And so what we are doing with this group that I'll call the activators, we don't have an official name yet, is we have women who are part of funds that manage funds, a part of this conversation. And many of them want this to change too. They just haven't figured it out yet. No. And I think that we can come at it from both ways. Like the VCs trying to figure out, and that us trying to get more female angel investors, early investors in too. And then we can hopefully together up the numbers and opportunities.
It feels very much like a lot of the same things we face in STEM and trying to get women into STEM, trying to keep women in STEM. It feels very parallel to that.
Yes. Yeah. There is a saying I read recently and I love it. It's out of Michelle Obama's book. It says, getting to where you want to go at some point, almost by necessity, becomes a fight. And so we're saying the same thing. So no matter what you try to succeed at, when you are pushing the envelope, pushing the glass ceiling, pushing whatever you're pushing against, there is a fight. There is a resistance. Yeah, I think it's for male and female. So I'm not saying just for females, but in particular, I believe this. I believe it's for a company trying to scale. I believe in any effort that we take on, that we are now coming up to the pinnacle, right? We're saying, okay, now we want to be in this upper level of success. And that is, there's a fight there. How do you brace yourself? How do you engage in that in a constructive way? To be aware of it is good, because you know it's okay. It's going to be. It's hard. It's not easy. None of my companies have been easy. But I just find that certain things helped along the way to make them easier than. So the struggle I'm having today is common. It's common among all entrepreneurs. So I believe everything that we do that's really worth doing, there's that, because we're pushing the limits. So it's going to be a little hard.
I suppose if it was easy, more people would do it.
Yes. And okay. Keep doing it. That's the thing, right?
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk about what you do in sports, because you also talk about that you are working to advance women in STEM and also advance women in sports. So how do these tie together, and how did you get involved in that?
I was involved with my current activities is with Tennis Canada. I am a tennis player and I love it. And been at a club level and tournaments and things.
Do you still play? Just curious.
Yeah, I still play.
Good for you. I played pickleball last night.
Oh, I love pickleball too.
It's the first time I played pickleball, but the closest I've been to tennis in probably a couple of years.
And I still love my tennis, and I haven't given up my tennis racket for pickleball. but I know a lot of people who have. But I became the president of what's called the Inter-County Tennis Association. It's Southwest Ontario, Toronto area. And we have 5,000 members, 90 clubs. I did that in the 2000s. And so becoming very involved. And then I started working with Tennis Canada. And last year, I received an email from them. And they said they are going to do a conference on equity in sport. And I said, sign me up. I'm right there. So I want to be there. I want to be a part of it. I want to help in any way. I'll bring in people. And so we did our first conference last year with Billie Jean King came in. And
Did you meet her?
She's outstanding lady. And she spoke, and then we had times to have photos taken with her. And she's just great. So what's common among this is equity. It's about equity, inclusiveness, diversity of thought. And sport is, I'm learning, I knew in tennis, but not in all sport, that there's big challenges. Oh. I'm talking about club level, community level, all the way up. You hear a lot more at the high level. But even in tennis, where are the coaches, the female coaches? There are not that many.
Actually, my son played tennis in the high school and his coach was a woman.
Glad to hear that. Yeah. And so we need to see that more at the higher level, the WC level and the ATP level too, for those male players too. Mm-hmm. I know that there have been male players that have had female coaches. So what we do, there's not equity.
No.
And so how do we make a difference? And so I'm part of this initiative. We're not only trying to have a conference, we're trying to bring the awareness at all levels. And again, it's again that grassroots, let's try to make a difference. Then we work with other organizations and we complement each other. And number one, we don't compete. We complement each other in this goal to equity in sport. And so I love it. I wish I had more time, but running my company is taking a lot, but I am dedicated to this one initiative now, Tennis Canada. So I'm excited to be a part of it, be a part of their committee to throw my 2 or 3 cents worth, or maybe my 1 cent worth in this movement.
That's awesome. You sound very busy.
I am. I am busy, and I have to learn to say no. And I'm learning that. And I'm also, I mentioned my friend who has this philosophy about philanthropy. So one day I was telling her all these not-for-profits and other things I was on. And she goes, you got to quit that one. You got to quit this one. You got to quit this one. And I said, okay, because see, again, it's about focus. And she said,
yeah.
And also if you've been somewhere for a while, you need to leave. Mm-hmm. And so there's this one, I work with the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics out of Waterloo. Mm. They're world renowned. And I have been the head of their Emmy Noether Council for 10 years. And with the Emmy Noether Council, we raise money for initiatives all the way from curriculum for junior high school, teaching teachers how to teach that curriculum for physics and math, all the way up to getting research chairs, $5 million research chairs for female researchers. This council has been doing this for the last 10 years. So I just resigned as chair. And I handed it over. And it was great to pass the baton and say, I love it. I still love the work. I'll support it. I had to say, now there's other work that I want to take on. So I'm not good at it, but I'm trying to be better at staying focused, and that my philanthropy and my volunteerism and all tie into my why.
Good for you. I love the work that you're doing. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want to talk about and share on the podcast?
No, I think we touched on all of it and all of my soapboxes. I think we covered them.
You have really good soapboxes. I love your soapboxes.
Thank you for allowing me to get on one and to scream at the top of my voice about how passionate I am about all of these.
They resonate a lot with me and what I do and what I have become passionate about, or growing passions in my life. So I'm really glad that we got this opportunity to talk and that I got to hear about the amazing work that you're doing. So I am really grateful that we got to have this time together.
Thank you for this conversation. And I hope we can have more, and I will keep you if you don't mind, I'll send you some of the emails about some of these initiatives to keep you in the loop.
Yeah, I would love that. I would absolutely love that. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
I hope you enjoyed Sherry's story. While I always ask people to rate and review my podcast, I also have kind of a special request. I would like you to message me either through email, which is ordinarilyextraordinarypod@gmail.com, Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn message me. I'm curious if this conversation around women funding women resonates with you, and if it's something you'd like to have more conversations around, as I would love to see if there's a way to build community around that idea. So please let me know your thoughts. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode, I'd like to ask you to do a couple of things, which are really important to getting these women's stories to more people. Share an episode with a friend. Number two, go to the podcast platform you listen on and rate my podcast. And even better, if you can take a little bit of time and write a review, that would be awesome. And number three, subscribe or follow my podcast by going to your podcast platform and click the plus or follow button. This way, you'll never miss an episode. And you can find me, Kathy Nelson, at www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com. And as I said, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn by searching for my podcast. Please reach out to me. I hope to connect with you. And please join me for future episodes.